All right, it's 11 a.m. So, Boker Tov, everybody. Erev Tov in Israel. A pleasure to welcome back Shuli for part three, the Dead Sea Scrolls today. As she mentioned last week, lots to do, lots to pay attention. So let's get started. Vakasha, nice to see everybody. And Shuli, let's take it away.
Okay. Hi, everyone. So we have, like I said, lots to do. And I am guessing there will be lots of questions. So please, please put them all in the chat. This is an enormous topic. And I'm going to start with a disclaimer, which is that you could take at least a year in university courses on this topic. There are many people who have made this their life's work and have PhDs and books. This is a taste of a taste, the tip of the tip of the iceberg. Okay, so if we haven't covered everything you want to know, don't worry, because we won't. But we are going to be trying to get a little bit of a picture of what is this story of the Dead Sea Scrolls? Why is it such a big deal? Right? Why is it so important? And what does it tell us about the time period we've been discussing for the past few weeks? And that's the Second Temple period. So first of all, let's try and just suggest, why is this such a big deal? First of all, when this was discovered, as we're going to tell the story in a few minutes, in 1947, the oldest Torah text before this was the Aleppo Codex. Okay, so if you know about the Aleppo Codex, you know it was written, give or take, 1,100 years ago in Tiberias. And it's not even a Torah scroll. It's a book. It's an extremely important book. But that was the oldest one, something that was about 1,000 years old. This more than doubles that, okay? Even if we're only talking about the Torah text or the Tanakh texts, this goes back 2,200 years. So that's a huge leap and a hugely important idea in terms of Mesorah, right? In terms of tradition, that we have texts that are so like the texts we have today and are so old. Okay. Besides that, as we're going to see, we have sectarian works that we have never seen before, that no one knew existed, and that give us a window into this time period. And perhaps most importantly, this time period, and we're going to see, we're talking about give or take 150 before the Common Era to the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70. This is a missing link in the beginnings of Christianity. This is a missing link in Rabbinic Judaism. It's a time period that we don't have a lot of texts that tell us about this time. And that's why these texts are going to be so significant for us. Okay, so that's just to give us a little bit of a beginning. Where are we going today? Okay, so we are going, very simple, really one place. Okay, we're going to go down to Qumran. Okay. Qumran is in the Judean desert. Okay, it's on the northern edge of the Dead Sea. As you come from Jerusalem, it's actually very close to Jerusalem. It'll take you, no traffic, about a half hour. Okay, coming from the heights of Jerusalem, from about 800 meters, right, 2,400 feet above sea level, going down towards the Dead Sea, 400 meters, 1,200 feet below sea level. So you have this incredible descent from Jerusalem down to the Dead Sea. Okay, the other thing that you have that you can see today, but it was much, much stronger in the time of the Second Temple, is that there are cliffs all along here, right? There are cliffs. And why do I say it was stronger in Second Temple times? Because today the Dead Sea is shrinking. It's been shrinking for over 50 years, right? But then the Dead Sea came up to the edge of the cliffs. So really, when you came to Qumran, that was pretty much the end of the line. If you wanted to go further, you had to get in a boat in order to sail down further on the Dead Sea, okay? The Judean desert has classically been the place for not only shepherds, right, and people who are out there with their flocks and seekers of God, right? Think about King David before he becomes king. Think about Jeremiah the prophet. But it's been a place of refuge. It's a place where you get away. And it's a great place to get away because it is away, right? It's in the desert. It's hard to find people out there, but it's not that away, right? It's a half hour drive from Jerusalem. So think about it as a half a day's walk, maybe more because of the uphill. We're getting away from it all, but we're not that far away. And that's going to be important because we're going to see that our people of Qumran definitely have knowledge and contact with Jerusalem. So that's just to give us a sense of where we are. Okay, the story of the discovery is a pretty well-known story, but we will tell it quickly. By the way, the Bedouin in the picture has nothing to do with the Bedouin who found the scrolls. He's just a nice looking Bedouin. Okay. In 1947, two Bedouin young men from the Tamira tribe, right? The tribe right near where Qumran is, they lost a goat. And the goat is a good climber, right? The goat scampers up the cliffs. And the next day, the goat is gone. The next day, one of them comes back and he wants to go see where the goat has gone. And he climbs up the cliff too, and he sees a cave. And he's curious, maybe the goat went in the cave. Maybe the cave is, you know, something interesting to explore. It's very dark. He doesn't have any way to light it up. So what he does is he throws a rock into the cave to see if it'll scare the goat out. It doesn't scare any goats out, but it makes a sound. It hits something. So he feels his way into the cave. He feels around. And what does he feel? A jar, right? A clay jar, which is what you're seeing here. These are in the museum. These are actually, I think, in the museum in Jordan, but we have them here in the Israel Museum as well. Okay. This Bedouin boy's name is Muhammad Adib. He takes the jar out. He drags it out into the light. He opens it up and he sees inside is a scroll. Now, he doesn't know how to read and he definitely doesn't know how to read this script, but he thinks maybe it's valuable enough that his father will be less angry with him about the lost goat. So he brings it home, shows it to his father. His father doesn't know what it is either, but they decide that they are going to take it to somebody who might indeed know what it is. Okay. By the way, just to be spoiler alert, this is the first of 11 caves. Ultimately, they found 10 jars in this cave, in cave number one. One of them had three different scrolls inside it, but we're getting ahead of our story, okay? They bring the scrolls and the jars to Bethlehem. They go to antiquities dealers who are not particularly interested in this. They don't know what it is. They don't really care. And then they find a cobbler whose name is Kando, Khalil Iskander Shaheen. And he says, okay, I'll take it, right? If nothing else, it's, you know, it's it might be useful in my shoemaking business, right? Very, very horrible thought, right? And he buys them, okay? Buys ultimately seven scrolls. Four of these scrolls are sold to an Eastern Orthodox priest named Mar Samuel, who's in the Old City. They are sold for $110, okay, which is unbelievable, okay? But three of them are sold to this gentleman. Now, Kando knows this man. This is Eliezer Sukenik. Professor Eliezer Sukenik is maybe most famous, not so fair, but maybe he's most famous for being Yigael Yadin's father. Yigael Yadin, of course, very, very famous. If you know one archaeologist from Israel, you know Yigael Yadin, right? He excavated in Masada, in Hatzor, in Megiddo, but this is his father, who is just as important in his own right, one of the founding fathers of the archaeology department in Hebrew University, one of the editors of the biblical encyclopedia, the Encyclopedia Mikra'it. He dug in the ancient synagogue in Beit Alpha, very, very significant archaeologist. And he goes out to Bethlehem to see what the story is. And he sees these scrolls, which up until now, nobody has any idea what they are. And of course he can read them, because as we're going to see in a moment, they are written in beautiful, clear Hebrew in the Ktav Ashuri, the square letters that we use today. And he recognizes it immediately. He says, this is the book of Isaiah, Sefer Yeshayahu. I know what this is. And he realizes that based on the way the script looked, because realize this is in 1947, we've already found ancient inscriptions. Based on the way the letters look, he believes it goes back to Second Temple times. And he is elated. He is so excited. And he goes back to Jerusalem. He hasn't purchased the scrolls yet. He will, right? But he goes back to Jerusalem and he comes into the city and he sees people are out in the street. They're partying. They're going crazy. And he thinks, what, did they hear about the scrolls? They didn't hear about the scrolls. It's November 29th, 1947. The United Nations has just voted to create the state of Israel. They voted on partition. And Eliezer Sukenik comes back. It's such a beautiful combination of circumstances, having got regards from the Jews of 2,200 years ago to find out that Israel is going to have a state. Okay. Eventually, he buys these three scrolls. Okay. And here's one of them, the Isaiah scroll. I apologize. I didn't make it bigger. We'll see some other scrolls a little later. And you can see them. If you go to the Shrine of the Book in Jerusalem, it used to be that the original Isaiah scroll was displayed in the middle. Then they saw that was not so good for its preservation. So they put a copy there, which looks just like the real thing, but you can see it and you can see that it is written in beautiful, perfect Hebrew letters. Okay. Fascinating thing, by the way. First of all, some of the scrolls are written not only in Hebrew, but in Aramaic, but the Tanakh scrolls, the biblical scrolls, are written in Hebrew. In the Ketav Ashuri, in the script that we use today, with one exception, right? One word that is consistently written in the old Hebrew, in the Ketav Ivri Atik, the script that they used in First Temple times. What word is that? The Tetragrammaton, Yud Kei Vav Kei, the name of God, is written in the old letters. Why? That's a great question, right? We have two possible answers, right? One answer is they thought the old script was holier, and that's why they wrote God's name in the old script. The other answer is the opposite. They thought the old script wasn't holy anymore. Better to write God's name in that old script. Either way, they make a distinction, and they write God's name in that script. We found, ultimately, we haven't gotten finished with the story of the discovery of the scrolls, but just again, a spoiler, we have found pieces, not the entirety like the Isaiah scroll, but pieces of every book of the Bible, except for one so far, okay? And that's the book of Esther. Is it because we haven't found it yet? Is it because the writers of these scrolls, the scribes of these scrolls, are not great fans of women? Is it because the book of Esther is somewhat later and maybe they didn't put it in their canon? All of those are fascinating possibilities. But what is even more fascinating, and this is what Professor Lauren Schiffman, one of the great experts on the scroll, says, we're talking about these texts are from the second century before the Common Era. And we are finding texts from all of the books of the Bible, which seems to indicate that we have a canon by that point, okay? That we know that we have the books, the 24 books of the Bible that we have today, they had practically intact by that point. And that's what I'm part of what we're talking about when we talk about this missing link, right? Understanding when does this canon start? We know that we hear discussions about this still in the time of Rabbi Akiva. Should we include Shir HaShirim? Should we not, right? But here we have all of these books. But let's continue with our mystery, okay? The three scrolls are purchased by Sukenik. The four other whole scrolls, okay, are owned by this Mar Samuel. And Sukenik wants them. And he travels back and forth to the old city, negotiating with Mar Samuel on a price. Will he get it? Will he sell it to him? For how much? Now, remember, when did this all get started? November 1947. What happens immediately after the United Nations votes on partition? The War of Independence. Okay, so the war is raging in Jerusalem, but Sukenik doesn't care. He wants those scrolls. And he braves the battles, and he goes to the old city. But no matter what he does, he cannot convince Mar Samuel to part with the scrolls. And in 1953, Professor Sukenik passes away. But don't worry, because the story does not end there. Okay? A year later, his son Yigael Yadin, you can see him here, right? He was, besides all his other brilliance, he was a decorated army officer, very important in the War of Independence. And in 1954, he travels to New York, and someone draws his attention to the advertisement on the left, which every time I read it, it makes me laugh, right? It's a classified ad in the Wall Street Journal. Miscellaneous for sale, the four Dead Sea Scrolls, biblical manuscripts dating back to at least 200 BC are for sale, an ideal gift for an educational or religious institution by an individual or a group. And of course, Sukenik is overjoyed, Yadin is overjoyed. He gets a go-between. He doesn't want to go as a representative of the state of Israel. He's worried that they won't sell it to him. So he finds a nice Jew in Brooklyn. There are a couple of them. And he asks him to be the go-between. And he wires, you know, the government. Can he get the money? He gets the money. He buys these for $250,000, right? $250,000. Remember, Mar Samuel had bought them for $110. Okay, so he made a very nice profit. But again, these are priceless. These are you cannot imagine how much they are worth. So now we have the four plus the three back in Israel, and we need a home for them. Oh, sorry, that's not what I wanted to do. And we need a home for them. And that's when in the 60s, okay, Israel builds the Israel Museum, right? It's a very significant national museum. And right next to it, or part of it, is what we call the Shrine of the Book, right? Meant to house these scrolls that we have. And this was built in 1965. The architects are Frederick Kiesler and Armand Bartos, and they build this iconic building, which even if you haven't been to Jerusalem, you've definitely seen pictures of this building. And it's all very, very allegorical, right? If you take a look at the buildings themselves on the left, right? And we're gonna see this when we talk about the works that were discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but you have the black and the white because of main idea in the sectarian works is this final battle between the sons of light and the sons of darkness, between good and evil. Okay, you have the white, which I always think of as a Hershey's kiss, but it's supposed to look like the cover of those jars, right? The clay jars. You have the water, which many people think it was some kind of a primitive 1960s air conditioning. It's not. They knew how to air condition, right? They had a way to climate control the Shrine of the Book. The water is because, as we're going to see, the people who write these scrolls are obsessed with purity, mikvah, ritual baths. Water is a very big deal for them. So the water is also symbolic. When you go inside the structure, and I'm sure a lot of people here have been there, when you go inside, you walk through a narrow hallway that opens up into this big open area, which of course is under the white dome. And here you have in the picture on the right, what's supposed to look like the top of a Torah scroll, right? That's Atzei Chaim, here it's already a facsimile of the Isaiah scroll inside. And one of the ideas that the architects had, and I think it's a beautiful idea, is you have to travel through this narrow hallway until you enter into this broad open area. Maybe only the women here will appreciate this, but it's meant to be an idea of giving birth, right? That you're going through this narrow passageway and then emerging. And it's giving birth in the sense of giving birth to rabbinic Judaism, giving birth to Christianity, giving birth, rebirth of the modern state of Israel, right? All of these very interesting ideas. When the Israel Museum was redone more than a decade ago, one of the things that was done, well, it wasn't part of the renovation, but it was done around that time, was they brought the model that used to be in the Holy Land Hotel, the model of Second Temple Jerusalem, and placed it right near the Shrine of the Book, but in a very specific way that you had to turn your back on Jerusalem in order to enter the Shrine of the Book, which is, again, symbolic, right? The people of the Dead Sea Scrolls turn their back on Jerusalem and go out to the desert. Meanwhile, the story continues, right? These seven scrolls are not the only scrolls, and everybody knows that there are more. Now, again, time has passed, and after 1948, the War of Independence is over. This area of Qumran, in fact, the whole northern part of the Judean desert, is in the hands of Jordan. It's not in the hands of Israel. It's in the hands of Jordan, under Jordanian control. So Israeli archaeologists have no access to it, but archaeologists from other countries do, and a race begins between the Bedouin and the archaeologists to find as more caves, more fragments, as much as they can find. Okay, ultimately they find 11 caves. This is cave number 4 over here, the entrance to the cave. They find 11 caves. They find some more whole scrolls, but many more, thousands upon thousands of fragments. Now the Jordanians are very clever. They pay per piece, but they say we're only going to pay for a certain size because they don't want the Bedouin to hack up the pieces even more. But in any case, there are many, many, many fragments. And the question is why, right? This is not just normal decomposition. And we think that maybe Roman soldiers, when they came and they captured these areas in their anger at the whole situation, came and hacked up the scrolls. We really don't know. But here, by the way, you can see in these little fragments, in this little one on the bottom, you can clearly see the beautiful Hebrew letters that are down here. Some of these scrolls are taken to Jordan, but most of them are brought to another site that is under the control of Jordan between 48 and 67. And that's the Rockefeller Museum, this beautiful archaeology museum built by the British in the 30s, now under the control of Jordan. in East Jerusalem. Well, not now. Now it's under the control of Israel. I meant between 48 and 67, not far from Damascus Gate. And what Jordan does is they bring all the fragments to these big halls of the Rockefeller Museum, and they assemble an international committee of scholars from the US and Britain and Poland and France and Switzerland and Germany. This international committee, very, very learned, very smart people. There are obviously no Israelis, but there are also no Jews. Hey, there are no Jews on this committee. And the idea is that they really believe that these are biblical texts that are going to connect to the beginnings of Christianity. What do we need Jews for, right? What they don't understand is that there are so many texts here. Obviously, this is coming from a Jewish milieu. That's number one. But there are so many texts here that are connected to Midrash, to Halakha, to Midrash Halakha, things that these Christian scholars have no idea and no understanding of. And their job is now to clean, to identify, to put the puzzle together. I always picture it as, take 1,000 jigsaw puzzles of 1,000 pieces each, put them in a cement mixer and dump them on the floor. That's what these guys have to do. And you can imagine that it's a little dysfunctional. They don't get along very well. The chief, the editor in chief here is this very young John Strugnell. When he starts out, he's very young. And he is an anti-Semite. He's an anti-Semite. He's also a drunkard. He has other issues, but he's an anti-Semite. He believes that Judaism has been superseded by Christianity, and he doesn't want Jews on this committee either. Now, it's all very dysfunctional and nothing is published. Okay? They work for 19 years and yet nothing is published. They don't work well. And there's also this fear that what if we find something explosive about the beginnings of Christianity? We don't want to tell that to the world. Now, even after the Six-Day War, much of this is kept under wraps and there is no access to it. Yigal Yadin publishes the Temple Scroll in 1977. It's very clear that these texts connect to Jewish history and to Jewish texts. People want to have more. The Antiquities Authority is dragging their feet. The committee that we talked about is dragging their feet. And in 1991, it takes till 1991, this gentleman on the left here, Ben Sion Wacholder, and a student of his, Martin Abegg, they managed to reconstruct one of the texts through a concordance that they have. And it's published by Herschel Shanks, who is the editor of the Biblical Archaeological Review. Okay? At the same time that they publish this text, there's a documentary about the Dead Sea Scrolls on the Nova Channel. And this creates a perfect storm where there's a lot of pressure to publish the text. And finally, the texts are freed in the 90s, okay? Not very long ago. Today, you can find all the Dead Sea Scrolls online if you want. It's not hard to find. But up until the 90s, they were under wraps and people did not have access to them. So, what are these explosive texts and why don't people want them to be seen? Okay, so basically, what we have to understand, and here again, you have another even nicer example of the beautiful Hebrew in the Temple Scroll here on the bottom. You have three types of texts. Okay. Number one, you have biblical books, as we said, pieces of all of them, except for Megillat Esther. The most prominent book, by the way, the one that we have the most fragments of, is the Book of Psalms, Tehillim. Okay, the people who wrote these scrolls are very interested in prayer, in Psalms, and by the way, they have certain Psalms that we don't have. And that's a very interesting thing in and of itself. Okay, now the biblical books, even though we knew them, are incredibly significant because for two reasons, for why they are the same as our text and for why they are different. Okay. On the whole, they are the same. There are very few differences between the texts that we have today and the texts that were discovered. And that's incredible, right? Whenever I teach this to students, I always say, okay, write a grocery list and give it to the person sitting next to you and have them copy it and have the next person copy it. And by the time you get to the fourth copy, you're going to have many, many mistakes, right? And yet Torah scrolls have been copied for centuries upon centuries and are almost completely intact. And that's because of the incredible care that a scribe has to take in copying over Torah scrolls. And yet there are some differences. And that's actually fascinating because there are problems that biblical scholars have had, Book of Isaiah and other places, that the psukim don't necessarily make so much sense. We don't understand the words that we're reading. And then suddenly you see it and you see there was a scribal error because we can see the original text. If you're interested in this, my friend and colleague, Dr. Yael Ziegler, talks a lot about this. And it's a fascinating subject. So that's one that's it. Rabbi Kalman, have her come and speak for you. That's one topic. That's one type of text. Okay. Type number two, books that are not in the canon. Okay. What we call the pseudepigrapha and the apocrypha, books that are from around the same time as most of the biblical books, but they did not make it into the Jewish Bible. Some of them are in the Christian Bible. Also books that were known. Okay. Sometimes, by the way, only in Greek or in Aramaic, and now we have them in Hebrew, but not any huge surprises. And then we have the surprise, right? The wild card. And that's number three, sectarian works, works that nobody knew about before they were discovered. And that's where we get to the really unusual story here. Who are these people? What do they believe? What do we know about them from their texts, from their works? And that's where most of the fascinating stuff is being written. Okay, so who's writing these texts and why are they writing them? So we have a lot of different suggestions. The most common suggestion, the most accepted suggestion, and like I said, there are people who devote their whole careers to this. The most accepted suggestion is that the people who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls are the people who lived in Qumran, and those people are identified with people that are described by Josephus and Philo and Pliny as the Essenes, who, by the way, we have practically perhaps a mention of them in our text, but really almost nothing. Okay. Like I said, not everybody agrees with this, but we're going to go with that because it's the most common answer and it's the most logical answer. Josephus tells us about this group. Okay. Now, what does he tell us? Here's a text from the Jewish War, a very famous text. For there are three philosophical sects among the Jews. Okay, that's already our first problem. Josephus is writing his book, The Jewish War, as we're going to see next week when we talk about the Great Revolt. He's writing it for Romans. Okay, he's not writing it for Jews. And Romans don't have halakha. They don't have law. So the main differences that we're going to see between the groups are actually in law. But he doesn't write about that. He writes about philosophy because that's what Romans can understand. But that's less significant to us. Still, it's helpful. The followers of the first are the Pharisees, the second the Sadducees, and the third, which pretends to a severer discipline, are called Essenes. These last are Jews by birth and seem to have a greater affection for one another than the other sects have. And now he's going to tell us about who these guys are. Okay, they are ascetic. These Essenes reject pleasure as an evil. They neglect wedlock. Okay, they are celibate, but choose other people's children while they are pliable and fit for learning. Okay, because they think of women as lascivious. Go on. Okay, so they are celibate. They are ascetic. They are communal. These men are despisers of riches and so very communicative. This is an old translation, right? They live in a community as raises our admiration, nor is there anyone to be found among them who has more than another. All right, so far we've got similarities to monks. We've got similarities to kibbutzniks, right? Which one is it? It could be a little bit of both. Okay, number four, they have no one certain city, but many of them dwell in every city. Okay, that's Josephus. We're going to talk about Qumran, but it seems there were Essenes in other places. And in number five, he tells us about their daily routine, right? Which involves a lot of prayer, a lot of purity and work, right? As for their piety towards God, it is very extraordinary. Before sunrises, they speak not a word about profane matters, but put up certain prayers, which they have received from their forefathers. After this, everyone are sent away to exercise some of those arts wherein they are skilled, and which they labor with great diligence till the fifth hour. After which they assemble together in one place and they bathe their bodies in cold water, right? While they're wearing white veils, also interesting, right? Purification, mikvah, very big deal in Bayitshani and Second Temple times. They change it a little bit. After this purification is over, they go into the dining room, they eat together, right? So we have community eating, ritual bathing before the eating, prayers, work. That's their routine, according to Josephus. Now, this, what's going on here, right? Who are these people? What do they have to do with other Jews? So the title is stolen from a colleague in graduate school many, many years ago. It's just a fun title. What can I say? If you were to come across a Jew in Second Temple times, right? 2,000 years ago, you're walking down the street in Jerusalem and you come across a Jewish man or Jewish woman and you say to them, who are you? What are you? And he'll say to you, well, of course, I'm a Jew, right? But if you probe a little deeper, do you believe in the authority of the rabbis? Are you are a priest, a Kohen? Do you think that the temple is legitimate? There are a lot of things that are underlying. Everybody sees themselves as the true Jews, but there is no one kind of unified division of Jews that we would say, this is a Jew, right? You have the Pharisees who accept the authority of the rabbis. You have the Sadducees who don't accept the authority of the rabbis. They have differences in their beliefs about what's going to happen after you die. They have differences in their interpretation of halakha, but they each see themselves as the true Jews. And this is where we have this great quote from Shaya Cohen. A sect is a small organized group that separates itself from a larger religious body and asserts that it alone embodies the ideals of the larger group because it alone understands God's will. We, whoever we are the sons of light. You, whoever you are the sons of darkness. We are the correct ones. Everybody else, sorry, you should do tshuva and you should join us. And when does this situation begin? We don't have such a situation in the time of First Temple and the time of the Bible. We have sinners, we have people who do idolatry, and we have prophets, but we don't have this idea that this one believes he's right and this one believes he's right. It's all not completely clear, but it seems that the beginnings of the sectarianism is around the time of the story of Hanukkah, and that's why I put this nice Hanukkiah here. Why? Because as much as the Hasmoneans save Judaism, right, they also do certain things that are considered illegitimate by other Jews. Number one, they're very Hellenized. Number two, they take on themselves the kingship, except that they are not from the house of David. Number three, they point themselves to be the high priest, even though they're not from the correct family, from the correct genealogy. Okay, so you have these Hellenized priests who are not supposed to be high priests, who are doing things in the temple and are making it more corrupt. We don't like that. And so there are groups that break away, the Sadducees, the Essenes. They are not happy with what's going on. And you get these different groups, all of whom believe that they are the real Jews. They are the true Jews. Now, what are the focal points of separation? Okay, we're going to see one of the biggest ones is the temple and how you keep the laws in the temple, how you interpret the law, right? How do you keep Shabbat? How do you keep purity laws? How do you interpret the texts? One of the slurs in the sectarian works about other Jews is that they are doresh halakot. They are seekers after smooth things. They're smooth talkers, right? They're sharp talkers. But that might be just a play on words of doresh halakot. They are doing exegesis of the laws, but it's not really. It's just a smoothness. It's just kind of getting out of the laws and what we're supposed to do. How do you actually separate? Okay, so probably the most important way to separate one group from another is by having a different calendar. Okay, and what you see in the picture here on the left is a very elaborate sundial that was discovered in Qumran. It's not just a regular sundial, but it's a sundial with all these concentric circles. We think it's a sundial that can be used throughout the year as the sun changes position. The Essenes, the people of the Dead Sea Scrolls, have a completely solar year. Okay, Jews, as we know, today have a lunar year that is modified by a solar year, right? We have a lunar year of 354 days where we add days we add a month every few years. They have a completely solar year, 364 days. Their holidays always fall out on the same day of the week. Having a different calendar is probably the best way that you can separate yourself from your co-religionists. Okay? Think about Christianity. You have Eastern Orthodox Christmas. You have Armenian Christmas. When you're not celebrating together, you are separating yourself. And think about the extremely important story in the Mishnah and Rosh Hashanah. Okay, one of the very few stories. The Mishnah doesn't tell us a lot of stories. Okay? Mishnah tells us a story about how Rabbi Yoshua says that the new moon is on a certain day, and Rabban Gamliel and the Sanhedrin proclaim it on a different day. And Rabbi Yoshua is following his calendar, and Rabban Gamliel sends him a message, and he says, on the day that you calculate as Yom Kippur, which I calculate as a weekday, you are to come to me with your staff and your money bag, meaning you are to publicly show that you are not keeping Yom Kippur according to your calculations. Is Rabban Gamliel necessarily right? No, but he under in his calculations, no, but he understands that once you have a separate calendar, that leads to division. Okay, so calendar is very important. Purity is very important, right? You and we see this all over the place in the Mishnah and the Gemara. The people who are careful about purity, right? The chaverim, and the people who are less careful about purity. And the people who are less careful are not going to eat with the people who are careful, and they're not going to buy the people who are careful are not going to eat with them, and they're not going to buy food from them, right? Going to the mikvah, how often you go to the mikvah, how careful you are about your dishes and your food, that's another significant way to split your groups. Okay, now we're saying this is happening all over the place. Are the rabbis talking about it? Do we hear about it? We have so much rabbinic literature. Are the rabbis talking about these people? So the bottom line answer, even though we're going to read a few texts, is that the rabbis are the inheritors of the Pharisees, of the Prushim, and they are the winners. Okay, they're the winners in this story. The winners don't have to talk about the losers. They could, but they don't have to, because the winners basically are saying, we are the true Jews, and they really are, because there's nobody else around, right? So the rabbis rarely mention other groups. We do have a little bit of talk about the Sadducees, about these guys named the Bothusians, the Baitosim, who might be a variation on the Sadducees. We have these intimations, like the story of Rabbi Yoshua and Rabban Gamliel, about potential divisions. We don't hear about the Essenes. We hear about a group called the Chitzonim. Maybe they're the Essenes, but really very, very, very little. Okay, just to give you two examples where we hear about the Sadducees, okay, the Mishnah in Yadayim. Okay, it talks about purity. The Sadducees say, we complain against you Pharisees because you say the Holy Scriptures defile the hands, but the books of Homer do not defile the hands, right? A Torah scroll will make you impure, but the books of Homer won't make you impure. What kind of crazy thing is that? Why would the Torah make you impure? Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, of course, very important Pharisee sage, said, have we nothing against the Pharisees but this, right? He's making fun of them. They say the bones of a donkey are clean, yet the bones of Yochanan the high priest are unclean. They said to him, according to the affection for him, so is their impurity, so that nobody should make spoons out of the bones of his father or mother. He said to them, so also are the holy scriptures, according to the affection for them, so is their uncleanness. The books of Homer, which are not precious, do not defile the hands, right? It's a very nice rabbinic discussion. And it's one of the few places where we hear this kind of a distinction between what the Sadducees believe and what the Pharisees believe. By the way, in a very classic topic, purity, impurity, nothing out there, nothing so unusual. Okay, the other perhaps more famous example is the Mishnah in Menachot, where we hear about this incredibly elaborate ceremony of cutting the omer, right? Of cutting the first grains, according to the Pharisees, on the second day of Passover. Okay, mimacharat HaShabbat, according to the Sadducees and the Essenes as well, by the way, Maharat HaShabbat, the day after the Sabbath, is Sunday. Okay, and their calendar always makes it fall out on Sunday. You always do it on the first Sunday after Pesach. But the Pharisees say no, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, any day of the week, the day after Pesach. So what would they do? How would they reap the Omer? They would go to the out on the day before the festival, tie the unreaped grain in bunches. All the inhabitants of the town assembled. As soon as it became dark, he says to them, has the sun set? And they answer, has the sun set? And they answer, right? You have this calling back and forth, right? It's like a gospel congregation. Is this on this Sabbath? Yes. On this Sabbath? Yes. Shall I reap? Right? Ktzor, ktzor. Do it, do it. Why do we say it so many times? Look at the bottom. Because of the Bothusians, who held that the reaping of the Omer was not to take place at the conclusion of the first day of the festival. So this is a polemic to say this is what we're supposed to do on this day and not on the day that you say. Okay, we will come back to the sectarian differences. Let's take a look at Qumran. Okay, Qumran is the site below the caves. Okay. Already in the 50s, there's an understanding that if there's stuff in the caves, there's probably stuff below the caves. And they start to excavate here. Now, of course, again, this is under Jordanian control. So this is not excavated by Israel in the beginning. This is a plateau. Qumran is on a plateau. Perhaps it's a place for prayer. Okay. one of the things, this is what I mentioned to you before, you can see it very nicely in the satellite picture, that we're on the cliffs, right? You come down from Jerusalem and then you are here on the top of the cliffs, very inaccessible, however, with water nearby, because otherwise they could not survive. Okay, two sources of water. A few kilometers on the road, you have a natural spring, a sweet water spring named Ein Feshcha. But perhaps more importantly, the residents of Qumran, like Herod does at Masada, a hundred years later, they figure out how to trap water that's flowing through the desert from flash floods, right? Coming from the mountains around Jerusalem, flowing down towards the Dead Sea. They figure out how to trap it. And we have a little piece of this aqueduct that's still left that leads the water directly into cisterns, directly into the ritual baths, the mikvaot that they have here, of which they have many, right? So they're taking advantage of the water sources that are there. The archaeologists who are excavating here are Bible scholars who are Dominicans, right? French Catholics, part of the École Biblique in Jerusalem. That's the picture that you see here on the right. And the person in charge is the gentleman with the beard, Roland DeVoe. And they are very, very reputable Bible scholars. But again, we are coming at this from a Christian point of view as opposed to a Jewish point of view. And it's only after the Six-Day War that Jews have access to this site. What do we have here at the site? This is a nice sign from the time period. I mean, from the site. Okay. First of all, the blue is the water in the aqueducts, in the cisterns, flowing into the mikvaot. Okay, so those are all important to understand. We are going to take a look at a few of these sites. Okay, we're going to take a look at, well, first of all, you have a guard tower, right? Because they're out in the middle of the desert, they need to protect themselves. Okay, the scribe's room, very important. We're going to take a look at that. The refectory or the dining room. Okay, what we don't have at the site, what was not discovered at the site, first of all, are the scrolls, which are in the caves above. Okay, we don't see where they slept. They slept presumably also in the caves because we haven't found anywhere that would show that there were like living quarters. Okay, what the other thing you don't see here are the toilets. They used they did not have any kind of way to relieve themselves in the camp. They went outside the camp to do that, and that's part of their whole purity issue. And the cemetery, which is also outside the camp. All you have here are the public buildings, right? And that's what you had in the site, the communal buildings, the public buildings. Remember, they're living a communal lifestyle, so that makes sense. Okay. The timeline here, we have some remains here from First Temple times, nothing very significant, a cistern, some handles. The main time period is two different parts broken up by an earthquake and a fire. The beginning of the settlement in Hasmonean period, right? Second century BCE. Earthquake and fire, the site has to be resettled. And then they come back the end of the first century BCE, and they are here until the Great Revolt, when the war that they have predicted is going to happen indeed does happen, only it doesn't happen quite as they thought it would. And then we have another short period of settlement in the Bar Kokhba era, but that's already not part of our story. That's a different story altogether. How do we know these dates, right? Besides the fact that we have the scrolls, we have many coins that were discovered here. Okay? We have pottery, the mikvaot are from the same style. The dates are pretty clear that we know when it's from. Okay, we have evidence of this earthquake. Okay, we hear about the earthquake in literary sources, but we also have evidence of it. Take a look at this picture on the left, the steps going down to the mikveh, which are uneven. Okay, they're kind of broken in half. And we also know that there were a lot of fires at this site. And the fires make sense because all of these buildings, we don't see roofs today because the roofs were made out of organic material, right? They're usually made out of wood, out of straw. And you would keep a fire, a lamp burning all the time because it was very hard to make fire in the old days. And it's a very, very windy site. The wind catches hold of one of these lamps, catches hold of the roof, and that's it. So fire is a pretty common thing that's going to be happening around here. We have found lots of coins, okay? One cache of 561 coins discovered together, other coins separately. And this tells us, proves to us what Josephus says, right? This is a community that pools its wealth. It's very much a kibbutz, right? Or a monastery, however you want to look at it, whatever your terms are. You would join the community, and we know from their works that you would have to give in money in order to join. You had a trial period, a very long trial period, by the way, a few years until you were completely accepted, and the treasure belonged to the community. And one of the suggestions, by the way, what was the appeal of this community besides, you know, the ideological fervor? There were hard times. There were years of famine, and you knew that if you came out here, if nothing else, you would get fed, right, twice a day, as opposed to if you stayed on your farm where there was no food. So that might have been the appeal, that the community had a lot of money. Okay. The picture on the right here is a very unusual scroll that was discovered. It's called the Copper Scroll. Okay? It's in Jordan today. It's written on metal. And it describes, it's not a biblical scroll. It's one of these sectarian texts. And it describes a huge treasure. It's basically a treasure map. And it gives directions how to get to it. And the question is this a real treasure map? Is it allegorical? There was a very maverick archaeologist named Wendell Jones, who tried to find the treasure. So far, it has not been found. The most exciting part of the site, for us certainly, but I think for everybody, is the area where the scrolls were written, okay? And this is called the Scriptorium. Today, you see it here on the left. It doesn't look particularly exciting. But when it was discovered, okay, they discovered tables, benches, inkwells. This is the place where the texts are written, okay? And you can see right next to it is another smaller room, which has these kind of interesting niches in the wall where we think scrolls were kept, sort of like a library, okay? And this brings us to a very significant question. Why are they writing these scrolls, right? Why are they writing them? Why are they bringing them out here? What's the idea? So perhaps they feel so alienated from Jerusalem that they want to have their scrolls with them here. They don't want to go back to Jerusalem. Perhaps they know, and they do know because they believe it in their end of days prophecies and their eschatology, that trouble is coming. And indeed, trouble is coming, not the kind that they thought it was. Or perhaps, and this is a very intriguing idea, they are so obsessed with purity. What are scrolls written on? They're written on animal skins. And maybe they believe that the animal skins should not be in the holy city of Jerusalem because they could have impurity, because they are a living skin. For whatever reason, it seems they write the scrolls here and they put them for safekeeping into the caves. One last place that we'll look at in the site itself is this large rectangular room, which is called the refectory or the dining room. Why do we think it's a dining room? Because the room right next door is a large pantry where we found all sorts of pottery dishes. So we assume that the dishes are next door to the dining room. That makes sense, right? The china closet is near the dining room. And we know from Josephus that they eat together. Eating together is a very significant thing for them. According to Josephus, they eat together in silence, okay? And according to their texts as well, okay? We have texts called The Rule of the Community, that talk about life in the community and all the things you should not do, okay? One of which is speaking without being called on in the meal. And what's fascinating is that everything that you should not do carries the same punishment, okay? There's an overseer, we would perhaps call it a mashgiach, right? Someone who's in charge of the moral development of the community. And his job is to punish anybody who does not follow the rules. The punishment is always the same, only in varying degrees. You get less food. It's a very Jewish punishment, okay? You get less food. You can't eat with everybody in the communal dining room, depending on how bad what you've done is, right? You could get less food for a day, for a week, for a month. You could be barred from eating with everybody, but eating together is very much a part of their sacred space, of their ritual. Now, here's a fascinating thing. Based on the size of this dining room, right, and based on the average size of people, it fits around 200 people. And that makes sense that would be at any given time the population of this commune, of this group. But what's fascinating is that in the pantry next door, there are remains of more than 800 dishes. Why do I need 800 dishes for 200 people? Because they have different courses. And that's where you get to something fascinating. Who has different courses in their meals? Not poor people, right? Different courses in their meals is something that wealthy people have, that Greeks have, in what's called a symposium. Our Passover Seder is based on a Greek symposium where you have different courses and you have different things that you do at different times. These guys so want to get away from the Hellenizing and the corruption of Jerusalem and of the Greek culture that's there, but you can never completely get away. The culture comes with you all the time. Okay, one controversial question. Josephus talks about them as celibate, as not getting married. However, in their texts, there are some texts that seem to imply that there were families, that there were women. In the archaeology, they have discovered a few things that seem to indicate that there were women at Qumran. Combs, men are not such hair combers, certainly not in ancient times. Jewelry, and perhaps most incontrovertibly, in the cemetery, they found skeletons that belonged to women. So this is another one of the questions that's really unanswered. Did they have women there? Were the women there in a specific capacity? Were there some Essenes who were married and some who weren't? An open question, right? But we want to go back to the literature a little. What do the scrolls tell us about the sect? So we have different types, and this is now only talking about that third category, right? Only talking about the sectarian works. We have books of rules, okay? The rule of the covenant, it's called Sera Hayachad in Hebrew, the Damascus covenant, laying out what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do, things you can do on Shabbat, right? Things you can do in the communal dining hall, right? Where you're allowed to go to the bathroom, right? Very much going into every detail of their lives. So that's the sectarian rules. You have what are called pisharim, right? Pesher, commentaries on books of Tanakh, which are basically a cryptic history of the sect, right? When you talk about, the evildoers in the Nevi'im, they interpret it connected to their history. As Professor Hanan Eshel, Zichron Tzadik Livracha, is a very good scroll scholar, important scroll scholar, says you would have to be an FBI cryptologist to really understand what's going on in these texts. But there definitely are hints at conflict with the people in the temple and the people in Jerusalem. There is prayer and poetry. They wrote many, many different kinds of prayers. For example, every Shabbat of the year, there is a different specific prayer, right? Very beautiful, actually. Okay? They have biblical texts that they rewrite in their own way, the Temple Scroll, and they have works of eschatology, of the end of days. Okay, what's going to happen? This big war between the sons of light and the sons of darkness. Of course, they are going to win. They are going to be victorious as the sons of light. So we have all of these different types of works that lay out their halakha, right? Their law, their prayer, their poetry, their biblical commentary, and end of days. Not so different from what you have in the standard Jewish library. The temple is always a focal point of sectarianism, okay? And that's one of the reasons why when the temple is destroyed, sectarianism essentially comes to an end. They feel that the temple is corrupted. They feel because of what we said before about the high priest from the wrong line, the high priest being corrupt. They feel that the halakha, the way the avodah, the way the temple service is being conducted is done wrong. Hey, it's a focal point of controversy. It doesn't mean they want to get rid of the temple. They want to come back to Jerusalem when the temple has become the right temple, right? They believe that there you need to have avodah, you need to have temple worship, but not the way it's being done today. Now, one of the most fascinating texts only published in the 80s. Okay, this is something that Professor Schiffman talks about, is a text called MMT, Miktzat Maaseh HaTorah. Okay, it's basically a letter that the sect writes where they list 20 laws that are wrong, that are done wrong by others who think they are Jews and that the sect does correctly. And if you take a look at this list and you've learned a little Mishnah, you've learned a little Gemara in your life, These are very familiar. They should be very familiar to you, these controversies. Okay. I bolded a few of the more obvious ones, but really all of them could fit very nicely into lots of different discussions in the Gemara. So for example, number five, the purity of preparing the red heifer, right? The para aduma. We have a lot of conversations about how that's done in the Mishnah. The place of number seven, the place of slaughtering and offering the sacrifices. If you ever learned Seder Kodshim, there's endless discussions about how the sacrifices, where exactly on the altar, in the Azara, where are things happening? Number nine, forbidden sexual unions, right? Forbidden marriages. Number 11, the purity of the stream of liquids poured from a pure vessel into an impure one. Huge conversations in the Mishnah and the Gemara about purity transferred or impurity transferred from one place to another. And so many others about marriage laws, about purity laws, about the temple laws, right? And what this does is it places our group squarely in the Jewish world. This is not some crazy out there group that is coming up with ideas that nobody's ever heard of, okay? They are talking about halakha just like the Pharisees and the Sadducees are talking about halakha. They have different opinions. That's fine, right? We hear a lot of different opinions in halakha. Now, they might have other things that are more out there, like the fact that they say you shouldn't go to the bathroom on Shabbat. But the majority of what they're talking about is what we are talking about in our texts. And that's what I meant. And that's what Professor Schiffman talks about as the missing link in halakha. Okay. And this is, I think, one of the most moving, perhaps the most moving thing that was discovered at Qumran, as more than one. And this is tefillin. This is tefillin that was discovered at Qumran. It's the oldest tefillin that we have. There are a few different sets that were discovered. You look at it and you say, it doesn't look like tefillin to me. There's no black box. There's no straps. Okay, there were straps, by the way. But basically what you have are four compartments with four little scrolls that are wrapped up and tied, not so differently from the way we tie our little scrolls today when we put them inside the box, right? With text, not exactly always the same text that we have, but this is tefillin. Now, why is this such a moving and powerful thing? Because the question is, at what point does the words vayula ot ayadecha ulatotafot bein einecha, right? It should be a sign on your hand and between your eyes. At what point does that move from something that's a metaphorical idea, which is how the Samaritans and the Karaites interpret it, to a real thing, right? An actual physical thing. Many people will say, okay, it's in the time of Moses already. And the Gemara definitely says it's in the time of Moses, but we don't have physical evidence of it until we get to Qumran and the Dead Sea Scrolls, until we get to 200 BCE. This is our first physical evidence of so many different things in halakha, and it shows us the progression of interpreting the law and interpreting halakha years and years before the first Midrashei Halakha appear. And that's really one of the powerful things, whether it's in the artifacts or in the texts themselves, because we don't have halachic texts that are as old as the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, what happens to these guys? Okay, what happens to them is that you have the Great Revolt, and the temple is destroyed, and the sects come to an end. Okay? And what happens is that the rabbis pulling themselves together after the terrible destruction in Jerusalem, right, and Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai going to Yavne and rebuilding the Sanhedrin. And there's a point where we say, okay, we are going to allow differences of opinion. Differences of opinion are okay. We have a big tent. We are allowed to have machloket. But there are certain red lines that cannot be crossed. And it's at this point in Yavne that we come up with what's called Birkat HaMinim, right? The 19th blessing of the 18 blessings, right? Where we basically want to make people who do not follow these red lines uncomfortable. And this is a very old text of the Birkat HaMinim. It's from the Cairo Geniza. Our text today is somewhat different. Lamishud madim al tihi tikva. Okay, to those who are converted, there should be no hope. Umalchut zadom mehirat te'aker b'yameinu, right? And there shouldn't be an evil empire in the world. V'hanotzrim v'haminim. Here we specifically talk about Christians. We haven't mentioned Christians, but Christians are one of these very, very small groups that are existing, right? The Christians and the heretics, karega yovedu, they should immediately disappear. Right. And this is the point where we say you can be inside our big tent, but you have to follow certain rules, right? And those rules are accepting the authority of the rabbis, believing in the world to come, not believing in a Messiah, the Son of Man, for sure, right? And that's where we get a reiteration of this idea in the Mishnah, the first Mishnah in the 10th chapter of Sanhedrin. All Israel have a portion in the world to come. For it says, your people of the righteous shall possess the land forever, right? A verse from Isaiah, but in a classic Gemara twist, these are the ones who have no portion in the world to come. Everybody's got a portion in the world to come, except for the ones who don't, right? And the ones who don't are the ones who don't follow the authority of the rabbis, who don't believe in the world to come, right? We're having our big tent, but there's a limit to it. It cannot include everything. Now, Professor Hanan Eshal had a very powerful idea. He said, if you would, you know, find an Essene, go in a time machine to the year 71 and find an Essene, because they weren't all killed, obviously, and say to him, well, what happened with all your end of days? You know, did it come true? Were you correct? And he'd say, no, we were a total failure. We were completely wrong, right? The sect does not make itself, put itself back together after the year 70. There's this terrible war of sons of light and sons of darkness, and the sons of light lose. That's us, right? And the sons of darkness, who it turns out are the Romans and not the Jews, they won. And we don't come back and reclaim our scrolls, and we're a terrible failure. But Hanan Eshal says, no, they're really not a terrible failure, because their legacy to us is the roots of Rabbinic Judaism and the roots of Christianity, right? The roots of Rabbinic Judaism, in, like we said, understanding these deep roots of halakha and where they are coming from in the earliest iterations of the written down oral law, okay, in the roots in terms of prayer. Their prayer and their is exemplary and is very powerful, and the texts that they have passed down to us. The roots of Christianity, if you've ever gone to Qumran, right, you will see buses full of Christians, and sometimes, and I've seen this, there are buses full of monks who come to visit Qumran, because they see, right, they see, and there's actually a crazy movie that they show in Qumran that talks about John the Baptist was in Qumran, right? But they see the Essenes as their spiritual predecessors. They're clearly not Christians. They're not early Christians, okay? But they are monastic, they are ascetic, they live a communal lifestyle. They take the idea of ritual purity of mikvah, right, which in Judaism is a technical thing, right? Going from an impure state to a pure state, it's not a value judgment in any way, and they turn it into something spiritual. So they're also following, in many ways, the beginnings of Christianity, or Christianity is following their ideas. So despite the fact that they, as a group, do not continue to exist, many of their ideas are passed on to the two religions that grow out of the destruction of the Second Temple, Rabbinic Judaism and Christianity. And studying their texts gives us an incredible window into who we are and how we developed. So just quick credits, and I will stop sharing, and I will take a look at questions, and people are welcome to ask other questions. Let's see what questions we got here. Going back to the beginning. I couldn't have left out Esther because they didn't like women since they included Ruth. I said it's a theory. We don't really know why they left out Esther. And it could be that they didn't leave out Esther, that we could find it. You know, that we haven't found it yet. It's a suggestion. There's also the possibility that Esther, and we have this conversation in the Gemara, right? Is Esther accepted? Do we accept this book? Is it part of our canon? Could you comment on the change of name from Sukenik to Yadin? I don't know specifically why he changed it to Yadin, but in the early days of the state, it was actually a law that anybody who worked in the government or in the military had to Hebraicize their name. Today, we don't have that anymore. Why did he choose Yadin? I don't know. Could these scrolls have been secreted out of the temple while it was being destroyed? Perhaps some of the very later ones, but most of these are earlier, right? Most of these are not from the year 70, but it's possible, like I said, that they know trouble is coming, right? So let's get those scrolls out before the trouble comes. You don't have to wait till the temple is on fire. Sex and Parties is from Gary Rensburg. I don't know who Gary Rensburg is. I got it from my friend Jay Zachter in college, but it could be other people as well. How would Josephus know the daily routine of the Essenes? Interesting question, Batsheva. So Josephus, We're going to talk about Josephus next week. Josephus lives a very interesting life. I think of him as the Forrest Gump of the ancient world. Anywhere anything happened, he was there. Okay? And he actually goes as a teenager. He writes this in his autobiography. He goes as a teenager and he joins them for a couple of years. So he knows a lot about the Essenes. Were synagogues found? There is a suggestion that one of the structures is a synagogue. No great proof. Okay? Where did they go during the earthquake abandonment period? We don't really know. And we also don't know if this was their only place. Meaning, we think that there was an Essene center in Jerusalem on Mount Zion. Okay? And very likely that they were in other places as well. We don't have evidence of it yet. How many people lived at the most popular time? Right. So this is what I said. We think 200 based on the size of the dining room and the men and women we discussed already. Communitarian lifestyle doesn't seem to be found in Tanakh, where the Essenes find. Okay, so we definitely have running as a vein through Jewish history from Tanakh till recent times. You have an ascetic and a communal trend. Is it considered to be the best way? Not necessarily, but there always were people who chose that lifestyle. So for example, in Tanakh, we hear about, in Yirmiyahu, we hear about a group called the Bnei Rechav, right? Who abstain from wine, who are ascetic, right? We have the Bnei HaNevi'im. Think about in the time of Elisha and Eliyahu, these schools of prophets who seem to be also living some community lifestyle that is very unusual, that is very special. And continuing throughout Jewish history, definitely never as strong as in the Christian world, because of course we have the idea of getting married and having children, and that's a primary value. But there always were people who that life was not necessarily for them. Right? Were there children there? We have not found physical evidence of children. One suggestion that people make is, as to, you know, if they didn't get married and have kids, how did they continue? Is that perhaps they adopted children. They brought children into the group, just like monks did. Okay, so monks, yes, we talked about monks. I don't know if I answered your question, Batsheva, but if I didn't, you'll ask more. Were the bowls pottery? Yes. Okay, maybe a lot because they were Mekabel Tuma. Interesting. I don't know if anybody suggests that. That's an interesting idea. Hi, Annie. Originally, the group at the Rockefeller used scotch tape to put the scrolls together. Yes, they had no sense of preservation. I mean, we can't laugh at them that much because I'm sure people will laugh at us in 50 years also. But yes, they did a lot of damage. Also, by the way, in the early years of the Shrine of the Book, like I said, the Isaiah scroll was also damaged by being put on display in that way. So I like Shia Cohen. Can I recommend a book? I like Shia Cohen about this whole time period from the Maccabees to the Mishnah. I think it's an excellent book. There's really a lot out there about this time period. Lawrence Schiffman is also wonderful, somewhat more technical, but really amazing, and also addresses a lot of this issue of Jewish law and Jewish texts. What do I think of the theory that the Zealots and not the Essenes wrote the scrolls? I actually don't know that theory. I know there are a lot of theories about who wrote the scrolls, but I would not go for it because the Zealots seem to be following a Pharisee way of life. And the Essenes clearly are not Zealots because when the Romans show up, that's it. They're finished, right? There's no fighting that's going on. I had read it was questionable if the scrolls were written there. There were ink wells found. There are suggestions that some of the scrolls were actually brought from Jerusalem as well. And we don't have so much proof that all of them were written there, but there definitely were some because there's tables, there's ink, there's something, right? Okay, that is it for questions, unless people have other questions. Other questions?
Yes. Speak up now or forever hold your breath. Okay.
I'll try. I'm going to take a breath now.
Julie, were scrolls sent to other communities?
Scrolls sent by the Essenes to other communities?
They had a whole bunch of people writing. What do they do with all those scrolls?
Right. Are they sending it out to their, like, you know, suburban communities around the country? That's a really good question. The reason the scrolls are so unusual, right? Think about it. Scrolls are organic. Scrolls do not last for 2,000 years, 2,200 years. That's very unusual. The reason they last here is because we're at the Dead Sea, because the climate is so dry, it preserves the scrolls. So you're right, David. They may have sent them to other places, but we wouldn't know because they wouldn't have lasted. They wouldn't have been preserved. or maybe we'll find fragments. But the unusualness is that they did survive, that they did last.
Did we find any traces of synagogues of where they died? So,
there is one opinion that there was a synagogue in Qumran. It is iffy at best because it doesn't have the classic design of synagogues that we know from this time period. And we have quite a few synagogues from this time period. On the other hand, these guys are not like everybody else, right? So their synagogue might have been different. According to Josephus, it sounds like, and according to the way the site looks, that they would go out on the plateau and they would pray there, right? And for them, it was a big deal to be facing the sun and connected to there. So that's an interesting question. I don't think we have any great proof about synagogues. Oh, Annie writes, this is an answer for you, David. Thank you, Annie. Damascus document found in the Cairo Geniza. Right, that's a fascinating thing. Long before these scrolls were discovered, right, in the 19th century, Solomon Schechter, right, Professor Solomon Schechter, explores the Cairo Geniza, which is this incredible, incredible repository of documents from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And he finds a document which he doesn't know about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Of course, they're not going to be discovered for another 50 years, but he writes how it seems like it's a Sadducee sort of a document. Annie, I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but that's a very interesting point to mention.
How do we know that this was the new writing as opposed to the old writing, if these are the oldest scrolls found?
It looks like it. You look at the text, right? It's very clear. We have two kinds of writing. We have what's called the Ktav Ivri Atik, the ancient Hebrew writing, which is what we find from all First Temple stuff, right? Inscriptions, seals, anything else. And then we have the Ktav Ashuri, the letters that we use today. And the Gemara talks about how Ezra comes from Babylonia and changes the script. And you can see it. All right, so that's the difference. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah,
the Cairo Geniza would be a great topic. I am not the one to give it, but I'm sure you could find somebody good.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, thank you, Shuli. Next week, go look forward to next Thursday, Bakasha. And this evening, 8:30, our rotating Parsha Shir tonight, giving by Atara Kelman. Everybody's invited. We look then forward to seeing you next week and future, and have a Shabbat Shalom. Everybody be well, be healthy, and look forward to learning with you and your friends. Bring them along. Okay. Any last minute questions before we let, you know, Shuli go? It's almost Shabbos.
Are we certain that they prayed communally?
I'm sorry?
Are we certain that they prayed
communally? According to Josephus, they did. I do not have more, and it seems like that everything they do is communal, but I don't know if I have any great other proof, or how you would have such a great other proof, right? How would you know?
You found no synagogues, right?
Right. You'd have to find a synagogue.
If you don't find a synagogue.
Shayakov's book title is From the Maccabees to the Mishnah. It's an old book. It's like from the 80s or something, but it's still excellent. And what? The other person I suggested is Lawrence Schiffman.